Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. A state analysis shows a stunning drop in Wisconsin's regulated family child care programs in the past 8 years. Marathon County documents a 55% loss, with even sharper declines in rural areas throughout central and northern Wisconsin, resulting in a crisis for families and what experts are calling a slow-motion catastrophe for the entire country. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. On Wednesday, October 23rd, Wisconsin Public Radio is one of several sponsors to host a free documentary screening of No Small Matter. The film documents the importance of investing in early childhood education and the long-term impact of early life experiences on brain development over a lifetime. Joining me today is Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria, a pediatrician at UW Health and American Family Children's Hospital, who is deeply involved in literacy initiatives, including Reach Out and Read, an initiative that makes literacy promotion a standard part of pediatric primary care so that children grow up with books and a love of reading. Doctor, welcome to Route 51.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
We're also joined by Rachel Giannini, an educator, early childhood advocate, and video blog host who appears in the film as a featured preschool teacher. Rachel, welcome.
Thank you.
Also in the studio, Marathon County Director of Special Education, Kelly Kapitz, who will explain the impact on families and businesses in our area. Thank you for being here, Kelly.
Delighted to be here.
Well, Rachel, there's a free documentary of No Small Matter on Wednesday, October 23rd at the Westwood Conference Center in Wausau. You are featured in this film. So what can you tell us about it? What's it all about?
So my one-floor elevator pitch would be essentially No Small Matter is a film about how we are failing our country because we're not investing in early childhood education, specifically quality early childhood. It follows three different vignettes as well as I always say you can know nothing about early childhood at all, see No Small Matter, come out with a BA in education and a master's in advocacy. It is a really just solid look at where we are right now as a country.
Okay. Kelly, can you explain your role with Marathon County Special Education?
Absolutely. My role is to provide special education-related services to 6 of the 10 school districts within Marathon County, all of which are rural schools. And our agency is charged with the task of not only doing child find, which is to find students who may need special education services, but also then to ensure that they have all of the services, be it occupational physical therapy, educational services, in their local school districts.
Okay. Before we get into really the science behind this, Rachel, I've got a question for you. I watched your video, and you didn't always want to be a teacher. You even went to college for something else. So what made you change course?
I had one more little class. It was a prerequisite, and it was philosophy. So I decided to take education philosophy because I thought, it's kids. How hard can this possibly be? My experience with school was in the Chicago Public Schools, where it was rows and worksheets and working by yourself and completely not my jam. So I am in this class thinking I'm going to know everything. And this woman comes in and literally says the 5 words that changes my life. She goes, children learn best through play. And I was so struck by that. I immediately took this deep dive into this idea that we can educate not only just through play, but something that's child driven and walking with a child as a co-learner, as opposed to everything I knew growing up. And it just felt so right. And goosebumps went over my body. And it was this idea of like, you know what? I'm not meant to be a sign language interpreter. I'm meant to be a preschool teacher. And yeah, that was my deep dive in.
Okay. Well, Doctor, you are a pediatrician and an educator. I know you've been very engaged in early literacy programs in healthcare settings, particularly around the ideas of early brain and child development. So I have to ask you, from a scientific standpoint, when does learning truly begin?
You know, that's a great question. And really, it begins right at birth. You know, some might even argue prenatally, although we don't have a solid evidence for that or ability to measure that so well. But really, it starts from the moment of birth. Children's brains are adapting to this new strange world that they're in the moment they're born. And the neurons start to wire in different ways right from those very first moments.
That's really incredible and something that I never knew before. And when I was doing this research, I found so much that was surprising to me about this. Kelly, over the past 8 years, Marathon County has lost 55% of its regulated child care programs. That is a pretty stunning figure. Is this mirroring trends elsewhere in the state, nationwide?
It is. It absolutely is. We're finding that not only are providers, existing providers, leaving the profession, but that new, highly talented, skillful people are not entering the field, which is just causing this ripple effect that's impacting children and families.
Okay. Can you explain the difference between regulated and non-regulated child care?
Absolutely. Regulated child care is the child care programs that are typically the staff that run those programs have some sort of post-secondary education, whether it be a certificate or a degree in early childhood education or child care management, versus an unregulated child care, which may not have any of those staff or personnel, maybe your Aunt Sue's daycare, home daycare, or grandma or grandpa. So the difference between the regulated and unregulated has entirely to do with the training and background of the staff.
Okay. So that's an important distinction to make?
Absolutely. When considering child care, you want to make sure that you are providing an opportunity for your child that has the right folks in the driver's seat providing the care for your child.
Okay. On October 23rd, the public is invited to a free screening of No Small Matter. It is at Wausau's Westwood Conference Center. We will have a link for that program for the information on WPR.org/Route 51 for folks who will want to see that documentary. Rachel, what are some of the most surprising things that viewers will learn when they see that film?
Oh, wow. That's a really great question. I don't want to give any spoilers away. It's amazing how I would go with the military. It's the number one thing that really jumps out. And there's mission readiness, these amazing retired generals who work for investing in early ed because of the fact that essentially 71% of 18 to 24-year-olds are unable to serve in our military because of the fact that they are too poorly educated. And that really strikes a lot of people. And rightfully so. So there's just a lot of, I call them Snapple facts. There's a lot of facts that come out of No Small Matter that make you stop and pause. And I think that that's the brilliance of this film is this idea of it allows you to see a problem that maybe you were completely unaware of, and awareness is the catalyst for change. So and also it's hilarious, and there's bugs involved, and it's just a good movie.
There's bugs involved. Well, how can we not like that, right? Doctor, in what ways are children benefiting from being taught at an early age? Is it social or better grades? What ways, concrete ways, do children benefit?
You know, there's a lot of talk about school readiness or ready for school, you know, those sorts of words. And I think we're starting to slowly move away from that as the core goal here, and instead moving towards what you mentioned in terms of what we call the socio-emotional skills. You know, we can teach a child, you know, how to identify a letter, but what's more important to me is not that they know their ABCs, you know, per se, although that's obviously a good thing by the time they're entering kindergarten if they know what the letters are. But I want them to know how to interact with other human beings, whether it's children their age, whether it's adults, older children, you know, whatever the case may be. Those back and forth, those exploration of social relationships, that's really all formed early on. And we can measure those in some ways, but they're not as necessarily as easy to measure as some of these things that are more amenable to drills and skills. So I think we need to be careful that we're not kind of teaching to the tests that we have, right? Oh, we can measure this metric and we can show that a child knows how to do this, when instead we should be focusing on, does this child know how to interact with the world around them? Do they know how to be curious and explore? Again, in the documentary, there's some beautiful, beautiful moments of really displaying that, both in the kids that are primarily seen in the documentary, but also in terms of contrasting younger children versus only slightly older children. And I think it really brings it home in such a key way what all of these skills are like.
Kelly, what are you hoping that people will take away from this screening?
Oh, there are several things that we're hoping that will happen. Well, first of all, as Rachel and Dr. Nafsari have said, is that an awareness piece. If you don't know that a problem exists, you can't engage and work towards solving problems. So we want, first and foremost, parents, community members, and all interested parties to know the importance of early brain development and in its impact on lifelong learning and health overall. And that once they understand some of the conundrums that we're having, including the child care issue, as you mentioned, we've seen a 55% drop here in Marathon County, which is equates to 1,000 fewer slots than we had just 8 years ago. And that's impact on families and children and their ability to have access to high quality care. And then, as Dr. Nafsari has said, those early learning experiences do impact the social emotional learning of children. And if you ask school teachers, 4K teachers, kindergarten teachers, the number one thing they're worried about is not their academic preparedness, but their social emotional well-being. Can they relate to other children? Can they play with others? Do they know how to play? And how are they in terms of handling overall emotions and stress? So as Dr. Nafsari said, it's so much more than being academically prepared. But what this movie does is talks about all of those issues, encapsulates it, and then causes us to pause and engage as a community into problem solving.
And Rachel, I know that you just came back from a screening elsewhere. What were some of the takeaways that that other communities have found from these screenings?
It's really interesting. The Nussle Matter has now screened over 500 times, and I've been very blessed to attend probably about 30 of those. And no matter where I am, be it in Alaska, be it Dayton, Ohio, or random places in the Midlands, every single takeaway is the same. It is the sense of urgency. And I was just in Alaska, and they were really focusing on the idea of what can the private sector do. Recognize the fact that maybe these big, large, sweeping changes aren't going to be possible on the political world. Like, what can they do at the very local level? And that is something that's definitely felt all throughout, is this take hold attitude of, now that we know this, the funny thing is, like, you can't unknow this. Like, once you see this, something changes in you. You look at children completely different. And a lot of communities are kind of just standing up and saying, like, you know what, like, yes, I'm going to hit up all of my politicians, but what can I do today? And that's been really inspiring to see.
And Rachel, you have so much experience in hands-on childcare. So what kinds of challenges have you seen in your experience when children are not exposed to educational opportunities in the earliest years of their life? What have you seen personally?
Well, for sure. I used to teach second grade, and I could tell you right off the bat who went to preschool. And it wasn't because of their letter recognition. It was sincerely, they had critical thinking skills. They had problem-solving skills. They were able to collaborate. All of those moments that you've already hit on really resonates in older grades. And that's definitely something that has really been impactful of recognizing that. But some of the issues that I've just seen in general is the idea of understanding what quality preschool looks like and quality ed, and making sure that those sites are available to the masses.
Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria, Rachel Giannini, and Kelly Kapitz are guests today on Route 51 as we continue our preview of No Small Matter and a discussion on the state of early childhood education in our area. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria, Rachel Giannini, and Kelly Kapitz are our guests today discussing the importance of high-quality, affordable childcare programs on families and on the workforce. So, Kelly, over the last 8 years, as we mentioned before, Marathon County has lost a significant number of regulated childcare programs, 55%. What are some of the factors that have led to that decline?
Well, there are a number of factors, actually. The first and foremost is finding qualified workers in the field. Many of our young folks are not choosing to enter into the child care work because of low wages. And so as a result, by young folks not going into the field and the job pay not keeping pace with market value, many of the folks find it just impossible for them to earn a living and to sustain their livelihood by going into early childhood education. It's not due to lack of enthusiasm, but in our region, we just cannot recruit and keep high-quality child care providers.
So, Doctor, I guess the interactive influences of genes and experience, they shape the developing brain. So there's this whole nature versus nurture debate. Which is really more important in a child's earliest years?
Well, to a certain extent, it is both. You can't have one without the other. But the fact is that we don't have great ways to change genes. And I think if we look at genes as sort of just a, we end up sometimes with a defeatist attitude that, well, this is just what this child is like. When in reality, we have great studies, including of like twins that may have been, for whatever reason, been raised in different households, having very different outcomes based on the environment around them. The levers we can pull, so to speak, are the interactions that young children have with caring, nurturing adults in their environment. You know, and this is really significant from a historical perspective. We used to, years upon years ago, think that kids didn't start learning till, you know, age 6 or 7. And then we, as science told us a little bit more, we move that down. And that's why we have things like kindergarten. The problem is we kind of stop there, this promise of universally available public education that we've had in the United States, part of the American dream. We kind of stopped funding that promise before age 5 and have kind of left it to this very patchwork system and not funded it adequately, which is in contrast to other developing nations.
So, Kelly, how does this issue impact the worker shortage or the ability to retain and attract talented employees?
Well, they're all really very interrelated. You know, business communities cannot thrive and survive if they can't get workers to fill their vacancies. And families cannot return to the work environment if they cannot find high-quality daycare or childcare. So if families cannot find high-quality, affordable childcare, they can't return to the workforce. And therefore, the workforce is short because the businesses and employers can't find folks to fill the vacancies that they have. So it becomes sort of this vicious cycle, if you will, for the childcare need and necessity and businesses trying to be able to run and operate businesses. And then, of course, as a family, families who can't return to the workforce have a substantial economic impact, which further impacts the life in their home. So if employees can't return to the workforce, businesses can't fill their vacancies, and so on and so forth. We find ourselves in this circle that seems to never end.
Rachel, you mentioned something earlier in this conversation that I found interesting. You talked about play, the role of play. Why is playing so important, and what's the relationship there?
It's motivation. It's the child's agenda. If you think about it in a totally funny way, it's like taking medicine with jelly, right? It's sweet, it goes down easier, and it's enjoyable.
A spoonful of honey, right?
Exactly. When a child is playing, there's this motivation to learn something, to try, to achieve a goal. And when it's their directive, it makes my life so much easier to be able to observe what's happening and then throw out those provocations, ask those questions that's going to encourage them to get somewhere very naturally. And if it also happens to be like, oh my goodness, you have all of these things, can we count those really fast? You are so excited about what you're doing. I can throw in some one-to-one correspondence, get some math in there, and you are none the wiser.
Well, what kinds of programs are most beneficial for children, let's say, from birth to 3? Maybe, Rachel, that's a question for you, I think.
Programs as in what parents have access to? Or
I think what are the best kinds of educational opportunities we could give our children from birth to 3?
Talk to them, read to them, and talk to them as you would anybody else with respect. It's amazing how children obtain vocabulary, and it's not by me pointing at a tree and saying, this is a tree, this is a tree. Use it conversationally. And Dipesh can completely agree, reading is huge. It's a massive, massive part of brain development early on. And parents, you often feel that teachers, oh, They got it. No worries. Parents are their first and best educators for their littles. Children are aspirational, and you are their biggest inspiration. Take control of that and make every moment a teachable moment. You're in the grocery store. Talk about what you're doing. Point things out. Are they talking back? Maybe not. It doesn't matter. They're reaping all of those benefits.
So, Doctor, I guess maybe you can expand on that. Why is reading so important? You know, those early reading skills, why is that so important? Books.
Yeah, and I agree with everything that Rachel just said. There's no one magic program that's going to fix everything. And I think sometimes people get hung up on the right thing rather than kind of thinking about, well, you know, how am I approaching my child and what can I do? One of the things about reading is that, you know, first of all, it's an activity that people know about, right? It's not something that we need to sit and explain in great detail, and it's a familiar activity. When you read with a child, you're, first of all, there's that loving, nurturing aspect of having the child in your lap or tucked up next to you. You're doing this shared, what we call joint attention. You're both looking at this object, this book. You can talk about it. They can ask questions. You can search for things. They can sit and listen quietly. There's all these different elements of this back and forth that we look for. And best of all, in a busy primary care setting, when kids come in for their regular checkups, what we do with the Reach Out and Read program is we give the child a book. We watch what they do with the book as a way to assess their development and the relationship with their parent and all that just from observation. And we talk to the parents about how to share books well with kids, not in the sense of you must do it this way or else, but this troubleshooting, asking, coaching, role modeling, and frankly also encouraging. That's the biggest thing here. Parents often don't hear someone say, hey, you know what? I think you're doing a good job with your child. And I think that's really critical for them to hear.
One of the things, Kelly, we had talked about is that you're really looking for not only an awareness through this film, through this screening, but also kind of getting a takeaway on some solutions. So I guess what can businesses do to reverse the trend that we're seeing?
Well, I think, again, awareness is the key piece. If you don't know that there's a worry or a concern in your community, and particularly that one that substantially impacts your employees, you can't engage with it. And so I think what we hope will happen is part of the No Small Matter documentary premiere on the 23rd is that businesses will continue or become engaged in the conversation and be part of the solution making. And those solutions may look different business to business, community to community. Again, we're talking about Marathon County, and while the greater Wausau area has the greatest number of population, we do have a rural community we also need to engage in, and those businesses and those community members also need to be engaged. So to answer your question, what we hope will happen is that people will come to the table and then, given their circumstances, will engage in creative problem solving to address the needs that meet their specific circumstance or condition. And that involves a whole bunch of us. There is no one entity that really has a solution to this child care conundrum. It really will take a multifaceted approach. And what might work in a neighboring community or in a neighboring state may not be impactful or fit perfectly with our community. So we really hope, as an outcome of this event, that that's what will happen, is a larger community conversation and genuine engagement, intentional problem solving as a collective versus one entity trying to fix our situation.
Do you think that this is a legislative issue?
I do. I think that it's multi-leveled. I think there has to be a recognition at the state and national level that childcare is not just a parent issue or just an employer issue. It's a community issue. These little people, or the littles as Rachel likes to call them, are going to grow up to be adults. They're going to be parents themselves one day, many of them. They're going to be employees or potentially employers. If we're not making that investment early with our little people, what is to come later on? If 71% of our population isn't eligible for the military, what are they eligible to do? And so as a community, from a policy perspective, from a legislative perspective, from a community perspective, we have to stop looking to others to solve our problem, but we have to come up with solutions in a really holistic, broad way.
Okay. I want to circle back to some of the science behind this. And Doctor, Maybe you can tell us some of the neurobiological effects of even poverty on the developing brain. Is there research behind that? Is there anything that you can tell us about that?
Yeah, there's so much evidence, and it seems like there's so much more each year that goes by. So we've known for decades that children who grow up facing adversity, whether it's poverty or violence or homelessness or lack of food or many of these things often coming together, of course, that they struggle. It's not a surprise that they tend to have difficulty in school and that their academic achievement tends to be fairly poor. We also see related behavioral issues and so on. What the last couple of decades has really shown us is two things. One, if you look at the long term, we're seeing physical health issues. We're seeing increased risks of heart disease as adults, 50 years later, connected to what happened when there was childhood adversity. And then the other fascinating aspect of all of this is that we're able to show not just the psychology, sociology, educational kind of routes by which this all happens, but now we're able to show through hormones in the bloodstream, like cortisol, which is the quote-unquote the stress hormone, MRI scans showing different parts of the brain lighting up in different ways. All of these are telling us, hey, these are the pathways underlying what we've been seeing societally for a long time. Now, on one hand, you can say, well, that's great, but that doesn't solve the problem. But what it does do is that it offers us ways to think about, okay, if we do X, Y, and Z, can we measure those changes in different ways and perhaps not have to wait 10 or 20 years to find out, okay, was there a good long-term outcome, but instead have there be something more short-term. But all this is buried deep in our biology. So the evidence is extraordinarily clear. We just need to finally figure out what are we going to do about this from a public policy perspective.
I saw a study that was conducted by the ABC Project that evaluated two groups of children for an extended period of time, those with formal preschool education and those not receiving any formal education in the preschool years. And their findings were really interesting. It showed that children with formal education scored higher on reading tests during subsequent school years, but also children who did not receive any formal education in their pre-kindergarten years were more likely to struggle with substance abuse and delinquent behaviors in their early adult years, which I thought was surprising. Doctor, does that surprise you or does that coincide with the research that you've seen as well?
It doesn't surprise me at all. There could be a few possibilities for why those things play out the way that they did. For one thing, even children who are struggling with adversity, when they have the presence of at least one, we hope it's more than one, but at least one caring, consistent adult in their life who honestly is just crazy about that kid and kind of shows them that, then we know that relationship, that nurturing relationship acts as a buffer against all these other things that can happen. So when kids don't necessarily have that in the same level as others, you can actually see some of these poorer outcomes. We also know that some of the socio-emotional things we talked about earlier, if those aren't built well early on, then they start to kind of feed on themselves and become more and more issues. You know, so I was asked recently about how to define socio-emotional development well, and the way I put it was, you know, gross motor skills help you to learn how to walk. Speech skills help you learn how to speak. Fine motor skills help you learn how to draw or hold a pencil. Socio-emotional skills help you learn when you should or shouldn't use all those other skills and kind of give you that sense of where those fit in the universe of relationships and human interactions.
Okay, Rachel, this question, I guess, is for you. I'm reading that young children, well, they naturally reach out for interaction. They babble. They've got, you know, their facial expressions and their gestures, and adults respond with similar kinds of vocalizing. We see it all the time. But what happens when those responses are either absent or inappropriate? Or maybe this is actually a question for you, Doctor.
I'm going to let the doctor take this one.
All right, I'll let the doctor take
sure.
this one.
Sure. So children are, you know, human beings are hardwired for social interaction. So babies that are born from within minutes of being born, or seconds even, when they have their eyes open, they will actually fix and follow on a human face. This is actually research I did as an undergrad with newborns. They're able to do these things, but then they need kind of more connections to move beyond into like actual, you know, babbling back, you know, cooing, responding in all those sorts of ways. So when kids don't get these interactions, first of all, if it's an unusual thing for them to not get these interactions, they get really stressed out. They get really upset because this is not something that they expected. But for kids who aren't getting these interactions, for whom it's normal to not have this back and forth, they don't learn these social cues. They don't learn to watch what other people are doing. And if it's extreme enough, we can actually see physical changes in their brain development that are seen on brain scans as well. And I want to highlight that this is not that their parents don't love them or don't care for them or are lazy or anything like that. I think their parents love them the same as any parent loves their child. The issue is that if you haven't seen examples and models in your environment of how to do this back and forth, then it's hard to know how to do that. And it's hard to know if you're doing it right. And so parents actually sometimes are filled with this self-doubt. Maybe I'll teach my child the wrong things. I struggled in school myself. Maybe my child is better off in front of this DVD or this learning app than they are in front of me. Well, the truth is there's no research showing any benefit for learning DVDs and apps and whatnot. There's no proof that they actually do anything in young kids. As I just heard at a conference last week, someone said, parents are the best toys. And, you know, that's the message that needs to get out there.
Rachel, you talk a lot about the importance of words and the impact of when infants and toddlers are exposed to more words, the positive impact that has. Tell us about that and the 30 million words movement. It's very interesting to me.
Yeah, the 30 million words movement was basically this study done that showed the more that you speak with children, the better they will. It's the long-term effects they have in education later. And you can even continue to unpack that where the stronger literacy skills you have, the higher rate you have of graduating from high school, the more likely that you will go to college and graduate. And it all starts with vocabulary, which is free, and really focuses on this idea that as something as simple as engaging and communicating with your children in authentic ways is one of the strongest leg ups that they have.
So what can parents do to easily incorporate more words into a child's life?
It is essentially, I always call it like, be your own highlight reel. Talk about what you're doing when you're doing it. We're in the kitchen. I'm making this. And you are just narrating your life. And as a little, again, they're just soaking this all in. You're identifying, you're providing vocabulary that they will know as they start to speak themselves. It may sound silly. People may assume that you are talking to yourself. You're not. You're talking to the most important person in the world. One of my favorite things happened on the bus in Chicago maybe about 3 weeks ago. And I couldn't see the stroller. And this woman was like, look at that blue car. And she just kept talking. And everyone around her was giving her like the what's up eyes. And then you realize that she's carrying a baby. And it was so breathtakingly perfect.
And I'd like to highlight something. I think Rachel hit it right on the head that even though the study really kind of set out this, oh, there's a 30 million word gap between more well-to-do and poorer families, it's really not about the number of words. It's about the quality of the interaction, the back and forth, the engagement, and all that. I don't want anyone to think that we should be developing like verbal pedometers, like Fitbits for words, you know, sorts of things. I think Rachel's absolutely spot on there that it's really about this back and forth, these interactions, and the technique of narrating your life is a great way to kind of call attention to things in the environment and build those sorts of, you know, turn-takings with your child.
Okay. Dr. Dipesh Navsaria, Rachel Giannini, and Kelly Kapitz, our guests today on Route 51, as we continue our preview of No Small Matter and a discussion on the state of early childhood education in our area. I'm Shereen Seward. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. we're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. Dr. Dipesh Navsaria, Rachel Giannini, and Kelly Kapitz are guests today discussing the importance of high-quality, affordable childcare programs on family and on the workforce. Doctor, one of the things you said in the last segment caught my attention about positive adult interaction and that impact on tragic behaviors. It sounded to me like what you're saying is even one positive adult interaction could result in reversing high instances in domestic violence, suicide, and other tragic behaviors?
I would say one positive relationship. I don't know that one interaction alone would necessarily do it. But, you know, so much of it comes down to when a child knows that there is someone that they can turn to, that they can rely on them, that they'll always be, that someone will be there for them even on their not so good days. That's tremendously affirming and does help reduce the levels of stress in that child and may very well alter kind of how they respond to that stress. We want children to have multiple loving adult relationships in their lives, but even one can make a significant difference versus, none.
Okay. On October 23rd, the public is invited to a free screening of No Small Matter. It's going to be at Wausau's Westwood Conference Center. We'll have a link for the program information on WPR.org/Route 51. In the trailer for the film, we hear that babies in the beginnings of humanity kind of grew up in these large extended families, but that's really changed over time because society has changed. We've got more two-parent households who are everybody's working or more single-parent households, for example. So it's a lot different than it was many years ago. So many parents begin educating their children before kindergarten, but not everybody does. So what are some of the factors that contribute to that? Kelly, maybe that you can answer that question.
To not educating their children earlier?
Yes.
Yeah. I think sometimes it's just parents, Dr. Navsaria said it well, they just don't know what they're supposed to do. And that's where the importance of a high quality early childhood or early care situation comes into play. Kids that are in those robust learning environments from 0 to 3, even if parents, their first and best teacher, don't feel as though they have all the skills, are also getting those skills. And so if kids don't have access to those high-quality experiences, it translates into kids who will struggle in school. So, for instance, talking earlier, when kids come to school, as Dr. Navsari was saying, maybe having exposure to adverse childhood experience and they learn maladaptive behaviors, they come to school that way. And so then staff are working very hard to provide supports and services to kids to help them unlearn some of those skills. And so it translates from even if parents don't know what to do, if they are during their working hours with high quality staff or educators, they come to school that much more prepared and that much more able, and in turn have a much more highly successful school experience.
So child care costs are pretty high. Let's face it. I mean, they're high here. They're high elsewhere, too. I was just taking a look at some 2018 figures. The annual average cost of child care, about $9,500 for one child, nearly $18,000 for two children. That is higher than the average annual cost of public college tuition in Wisconsin, which is just under $9,000. So why are the costs so high?
Well, the cost of care is high. And even when I say that, I want to return to what we were talking about earlier, the fact that people are not going into early childhood education because the living wage that they themselves make sometimes for those workers make it unaffordable for they themselves to send their own children to daycare or childcare. So you're looking at I can't tell you the cause of the high cost, but I can tell you that early childhood education is expensive, but it's worth it. And it's worth it because for every dollar that we will spend or invest in early childhood education, down the road into adulthood, we can save as much as $13 to $14 on our investment. And so that child whom we invest in early with quality learning experiences and positive life experiences will save us down the road in things like jails or social services or other things that these children who grew up to be adults might experience because they didn't have access to those early learning experiences. So it's so important that not only do we look at just the cost of the care, but what you're getting for high quality care. And is that investment early worth it now when it's easier to intervene and provide those opportunities than it is later in life when it's far more difficult, not impossible, but far more difficult to undo some of the effects of those negative experiences.
So, Rachel, I mean, you were involved in the documentary creation process. You appear in the documentary. You'll be here for the screening, yes?
And
yes. And at other screenings, I mean, what kind of reaction are you getting when people look at this film and they learn what the problem is? What do they say?
Well, it's often anger. They're completely ticked off and wonderful about it. I love that. Nothing's better than having the film, all the house lights come up and people just look at each other like, okay, now what? What are we going to do? And that's one thing I'm really excited about coming up here is the call to action for all of the local businesses to get involved is huge because it does take a village. It doesn't matter if you are a parent. If you plan on getting old, you need to invest. Because I can tell you right now, I really want somebody who's empathetic taking care of me as an adult. And even though they're 20% of our population now, they're 100% of our future. And it's these little moments that really galvanize every audience to let's do something, let's make a change, because I know now that I'm responsible for benefiting all of our littles out there.
Kelly, do you see the possibility of businesses ever offering early childhood education, like tuition, as a maybe an optional employee benefit on their own or even co-oping with other businesses? Do you think that's a possibility?
Absolutely. And again, as one of the outcomes of having our No Small Matter, what we're hoping is that by engaging our business communities, and not just our business communities, it could be our faith communities, our school communities, and finding ways to bring affordable, high-quality care to all of our children. I do see the momentum definitely moving in the right direction for us to do more of that, whether it's part of a benefit package, whether it's a stipend, whether it's in some cases providing on-site childcare themselves or providing what I will call scholarships to take to a qualifying daycare or childcare center so that the employee themselves can afford that access. I definitely see the possibilities being endless in ways in which the community at large can engage in solving this problem.
Doctor, you're going to be here for the screening as well. What will you be sharing? What do you want people to take away from this?
Yeah, I think that really for the main takeaway message is how important this is and how the current state of affairs in early childhood is nowhere near what the science has now very clearly told us. As I said earlier in the program, that we used to not think that kids learned from an early age, and now that much we know, but our structures, our systems to educate children from a young age haven't really kept up. So what we end up with is this really patchwork system that we have right now. I think that it's important that we recognize that part of the cost issue is, again, not that early childhood educators are getting rich. I mean, far from it. They can barely afford to live on what they're making and often, you know, can't and have supplemental jobs. But the other part of this is recognizing that, you know, you can't just simply put one teacher and 30 infants in a classroom, right? There's a reason that there's ratios that licensing holds up. You know, young kids need a lot more individual attention. It takes a lot of work and effort and energy to be able to do this and do this well. But it's well worth it, as Kelly pointed out.
And Doctor, it seems like there's been a revolution of sorts in our understanding of early childhood development, probably over the past two decades. What do we know now that we didn't know before?
Mm-hmm. We know that the number one factor that influences long-term outcomes are strong, loving, nurturing relationships between young children and the adults in their life. And everything we do, if we do nothing else, everything we do should be aimed at protecting and promoting the existence and endurance of those relationships, whether that's through home visiting programs, whether it's through living wages, so parents aren't working 2 to 3 jobs and continually away from their kids, you know, all the time, whether it's high quality early childhood education. All of those things are in service to that. I once heard from someone who really just summarized it beautifully, saying that the difference between other developed countries and the United States is that other developed countries took the valuable first 1,000 days of life and they built systems and financing to support what happened in those first 1,000 days. In the U.S., we understand that to a certain extent, but we didn't bother to build those systems and we didn't really bother to finance it. We kind of dumped it on this patchwork system.
I would like to just add to Dr. Nafsaria's work, too, to say that in talking about business communities and faith communities getting involved, you know, there are other things that businesses can do that may be low cost or no cost, which could include everything from flexible work hours, job sharing opportunities. So there are things that our community can do in talking about building systems around that first 1,000 days that doesn't necessarily have to equate to large monetary investments. And not that I'm not advocating for monetary investments, because I most certainly am, but there are a lot of other ways that we can look at supporting families that may not be quite as expensive as a full tuition for, say, a child care center.
So, Kelly, I guess what potential role do you see state and government policies, state, even national government policies, perhaps, having on the future of early childhood education? What do you see there?
I think that's hard to say, but a couple of things that could happen were, you know, longer paid leave opportunities for families, talking about the minimum wage and working wages for families. Many of our, as we talked earlier, many of our own child care providers cannot themselves sustain their own families, let alone afford child care. So as policymakers, I think it's not enough to just say, yes, we recognize there has to be mechanisms in place to support families. And so if that's increasing their wage, looking at longer leaves, paid leave for families, and then looking at maybe statewide or nationalwide systems to financially support or stipend or even tax credits for childcare that would help offset the expense and add credibility to the need for that by adding some monetary reduction through taxation or some of our tax laws.
There's an interesting aspect of, you know, how we often talk about tax burden and all. If you look at the United States' tax burden on average, it's actually fairly low compared to many developed nations. If you add in things like early childhood education and other things that are not covered and health insurance, suddenly, actually, we have a very high tax burden, essentially, but it's not as organized as it is in other nations.
Rachel, when you've gone to screenings in other communities, what kinds of solutions are they talking about?
It's actually right on par with everything we're talking about here. Simple things is just offering a flex work schedule, able to provide scholarships when you are. The one thing that Kelly mentioned that I absolutely love is the idea of what does it look like for a community to support an educator? Because that is one thing that we keep throwing out, that educators don't make a lot. I'm talking under $10. I worked 2 jobs my entire career of teaching. And ultimately, the reason why I left is just because of the fact I was horrifically burnt out. And I mean, I didn't get into it for money, but I can't pay my bills with hugs. So I really love this idea that Kelly brought up of like, let's talk about what as a community we can do to support our educators as well. But other than that, everybody is really riding the same wave of just providing not only access, but flexibility and recognizing the fact that these 1,000 days are really important. So how can we support the family that supports that?
You know, Kelly, I wanted to ask you, we talked a little bit earlier about the difference between regulated and non-regulated childcare. What goes into the regulation process?
I'm not the expert in that area, but what I can tell you, and I mentioned earlier, is not only the certification or the training of the staff, but also the state regulation process. States have a procedure for investigating the learning environment, looking at the staff credentials, the safety of the system, and states then attribute a licensure to those daycares to demonstrate that they have met a basic minimum of requirement. In the state of Wisconsin, we have a Young Star rating that helps us determine what level of skill or quality a particular child center has, whether it's a group daycare or a home daycare. So the Young Star rating provides us a mechanism to look and evaluate the quality of the daycare. So it's not just just a mom and pop that open up a daycare or a child care center, but it's looking at the whole system in terms of whether or not the daycare setting is licensed by an accredited licensing agency and meeting a basic level of a criteria to be a child care.
So what is your hope over the next 3 to 5 years? What do you think should happen?
Well, I hope that in our area, one, we'll get back to having availability of high-quality, affordable child care, which would be key for our families and our children. And I hope that those child care settings are of high quality, that they're 3 stars or higher and meet the basic minimum requirement for providing services and care to our kids. So regionally speaking, just about Marathon County, if we could get back those slots, I think what it could mean for our families and in our business communities, if we would have access to that high quality care for our children.
One final question, briefly, Rachel. That documentary screening for No Small Matter is on October 23rd at Westwood Conference Center in Wausau. What are you most excited for people to learn?
Ooh.
Hard to pick one thing.
About what I'm going to learn. Yeah. I know the one thing. I think that you're not alone. For any, I always like to speak to the educators. For any educator that's out there who often feels that they don't have a voice, this film is really empowering. It allows you to see yourself and be recognized in a way that we often don't get that. So that's my one thing, but there's about a billion.
I'm sure. That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. I'd like to thank our guests, Dr. Dipesh Nafsaria, Rachel Giannini, and Kelly Kapitz. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer, who is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program and a link to information about the upcoming No Small Matter documentary screening at WPR.org/Route51. Next week, we'll welcome State Representative Katrina Shanklin for a response to an earlier discussion on nitrates in Wisconsin wells and what state lawmakers are doing to ensure clean water for all. Until then, we're heading out of town.